You are listening to the voice of Ahlus Sunnah wal Jama'ah.
Markaz al-Sahaba.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Well, had a bit of a different nizam there coming into my show. Not the usual one. I prefer the other one, but okay. We'll make do. Happy. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Well, welcome to another edition of Business Matters with me, your host, Alameen Templeton. After a rather quiet and sedate Monday, everyone's still kind of like digesting that sudden increase in rand value last week after Moody's forewent shooting a bullet through our heads. Is that one way of seeing it? Maybe, if Moody's had issued an assessment of South Africa rather than just an unofficial opinion, our economy could have even given a better boost than what we did get, because if we're going to remain on investment grade, that was the big news that everyone wanted to hear. And Moody's kind of like let that out around like the 20th paragraph down. Oh, by the way, although, you know, if it hasn't removed our investment grade, that's maybe one reason why we've retained it. I think the country could have benefited from a full on official assessment of our debt ratings rather than just Moody's foregoing issuing a full formal assessment, given its opinion. Not that its opinion is supposed to count anything, although obviously the opinion did have a very good effect on our markets. But I think we could have got a bit more out of Moody's than what we did get. Anyway, Moody's, just like everyone else, are nervous to know what's going to be happening with the elections in May. Quite a few elections going on around the world, aren't there? Even apartheid Israel is holding sham elections in its own country, pretending that it's a democracy like apartheid South Africa. Apartheid Israel uses exactly the same kind of terms and language and also policies. When in actual fact, you know, they're more murderous than the apartheid regime. Far more murderous. Bloodthirsty, I think you could describe them. I guess that's just the way Nazis go, you know. Even Nazi Israel is going to be holding sham elections next month, actually. Are they going to re-elect old Benji to the forefront of are they going to put his finger on the trigger again? It seems like they like to kill Palestinians or any dirty Semites that call Muslims. I wonder where Israel is going to be after their elections. What happened in Israel today is the Reserve Bank forewent increasing interest rates. So very interesting. But anyway, we'll be having a look at Zionist interest rates coming up a bit later in the show. We are going to be looking at the Tshwane Metro. Is the DA running it cleaner than ANC? The World Bank has cut its growth forecast for sub-Saharan Africa. What does that mean for us? What does it mean for our neighbors? Iqbal Servers, AO Technology, grossly overvalued, says its own CIO, the Chief Information Officer. Also says that in actual fact, half of the company is illegitimate. It doesn't have real clear books. A lot of dirty laundry coming out at the PIC inquiry today. I must say independent newspapers looking a lot more tattered and sad than it was looking. And you would not have believed that it could get sadder under Tony O'Reilly, a real carpet-bagging capitalist, that one. But it would appear that Iqbal Server is very much cut in the same cloth. Unfortunately, the JSE has been called to testify in the PIC inquiry. They want to check up on some claims that Iqbal Server made during his testimony. I'd just like to point out, you can't be held in contempt of a commission of inquiry by giving false information. You can only be found contempt of an inquiry by prejudging or pre-publishing its findings. You can say these are the findings of the public inquiry and they're not, you've just made them up. That's the only way you can be found in contempt of an inquiry. So Iqbal Server knows I don't know, maybe he doesn't know. But if you didn't know, Mr. Iqbal, I can assure you that if the inquiry finds that you lied to them, you can't be held in contempt. So you can relax a little bit. After what I guess was a very rough day. They're not going to be looking good in the newspapers tomorrow, most principally your arch enemy, Business Day. Not that your business report has done much difference under your command. You know, goes on about white capital, white capital, white capital. But when he gets in charge, what has he done with these newspapers? A real amateur in charge. And I mean, that's what analysts from the Public Investment Corporation, the government's administrator for its pension funds, and that's what analysts at the PIC were saying. This guy, he's an amateur. He's got absolutely no experience in publishing. How can we give him a loan to help him buy this group? Nevertheless, they went ahead. Now it's like watching a spoiled child, really, seriously. I mean, Iqbal Servais strikes me as being the kind of guy whose mother loved him a little bit too much when he was young. I mean, it's where he brought down apartheid single-handedly, the way he goes on. But I'll tell you what, many of the journalists working at his newspaper group, some of them white, did a lot more than what he did. And he has gone and trashed, well, you know, they stood by while Tony O'Reilly trashed their reputation. So they can't really complain, you know. I think it was something like about 20 years of Tony O'Reilly. And all of those people who stood up and complained while Iqbal Servais took over, they said nothing while Tony O'Reilly raped that company. And then suddenly they discover their outrage when a black person takes over. I would say there was a very strong racial element to a lot of the protests about Iqbal taking over. Unfortunately, it would appear that many of those protests were quite accurate, unfortunately, I must say. So anyway, let's go and have a look at the tail of the tape. In as much as the JSE is a bellwether for our economy, you can go and tell that to people in Toyandu, in Bushbuck Ridge, in places like that, and they will tell you they don't even know what the JSE is. Is the JSE important? I always used to wonder when I was walking through Sandton, if someone dropped an atom bomb on Sandton and killed all of the lawyers and the accountants and the traders, and would the country be better off or worse off? Would the economy recover the next day? I wonder. Anyway, the JSE finished in the green again today. Only had one red day last week, no, two on Monday and Thursday. Everything else was in the green. Today it's in the green again. However, the rand has retraced some steps against the dollar. It's up against the pound and the euro. But that's according to valuations on Sunday, compared to valuations on Sunday. I like to compare valuations to the previous day when I was actually reporting on them. So we can kind of like remain in the same book, if you know what I mean. According to that measure, well, the JSE, yes, the JSE is up. The rand is trading at 14.10 to the dollar today. No, on Friday it was trading at 14.10. Today the dollar closed at 14.9. So we are a little bit stronger there, although it's kind of like showing an arrow downwards on, well, that is actually a recovery, the way they do it on Chenet. We can see that the pound value, we're 18.39 today, and we are on 18.40 on Friday. So yeah, very much round about in the same boat we were. We have, however, gained ground against the Turkish lira. Not surprising, it's under severe pressure and has been under severe pressure since last year. American banks waging economic warfare against Turkey. I'm not going to put it in any other way. And when South Africa's thoughts misbehaving, they're going to do exactly the same thing to us, because basically, in many ways, we are in the same kind of boat with Turkey. We're among 20 emerging market currencies that have been identified by Bloomberg to be taken out by the stronger currencies of the developed world. I wonder what a Bloomberg editor would think hearing me saying that. But that's kind of like the way I see it. I mean, if you read Bloomberg, you'll see whenever they speak about the rand, they'll say, yeah, the rand in comparison to 20 currency pairs, or currency peers rather, Those 20 currency pairs are basically emerging market currencies that have been identified as being vulnerable currencies that can be used to loot resources from those countries. And that's essentially what happens with South Africa on a daily basis with our currency transactions. With the collusion, I would like to say, of Reuters and Bloomberg, they both have their currency trading platforms are the main currency trading platforms in the world. So now when Reuters says, oh, Financial Times has said that the trade talks between the United States and China have hit a rut and they're likely to go down, then all of the traders using Reuters trading platform say, all right, cool, man, there's a signal. We can knock the UN, or we can knock the RAND, or we can go to war against emerging currencies. And, you know, it's basically, it seems to me that Bloomberg and Reuters essentially establish the main, what's the word when you're biased against something, you have inherent prejudice. Yeah, basically, it seems to me that on a daily basis, Bloomberg and Reuters act as the main ground prejudice, an excuse to take out a currency. If you want to take out a currency, you want a better currency today, we put in this news bulletin out based on our trading platform. So now, to what extent does trading on the trading platform inform Reuters journalism? And to what extent does Reuters journalism inform trading on the platform? Are there, you know, they call them Chinese walls, and are the Chinese walls as inscrutable as one should presume? Or is it just a misnomer? Because really, I think it's very dodgy as a journalist that journalist organizations, media organizations, can in actual fact be so close to and a participant in the market. There can absolutely be no journalism coming out of Bloomberg, no journalism coming out of Reuters. As long as they are participants in the market, well, then you can't trust a word that comes out of them. As long as they have those trading platforms, as far as I'm concerned, they're not even journalist organizations. I mean, they're public relations organizations. That's what they are. It is completely unacceptable that organizations claiming to be journalism organizations are in actual fact like the main participants in the markets. I'm sure that they would like to say that in actual fact, you know, they do maintain an arm's length relationship and all that kind of nonsense. But that's unacceptable for me. Maybe we should get the competition onto our show and discuss this in a bit more detail. I really think it is an issue that needs to be highlighted in South Africa, that these are sham, or these are not journalist organizations. They're currency trading platforms. It's a public relations exercise for Bloomberg's currency trading platform. That's what Bloomberg is. It's not a news organization, just as much as Reuters. It's not a news organization. That's my way. That's the way I see it. So the Tshwane Metro, the ANC and the DA have been arguing with each other over the last while over what's been happening in Tshwane. The DA came in and they said, well, there you see, we have turned a deficit in the previous year under the previous administration into a surplus. The ANC said, that's a lot of nonsense. We didn't leave Tshwane in debt. We didn't leave them with a whole lot of lousy stuff in their books. We left them healthy and clean looking, and it was nice. We left them with a surplus. This DA doesn't know what they're talking about. So anyway, on the one hand, the DA says that they inherited R1 billion surplus, and in 1 year in office, they turned that into a surplus. R1 billion deficit, and in 1 year they turned it into a surplus. The DA was elected to govern Tshwane in 2016. In August, when it took over the running of the municipality from the ANC, what remained in the city coffers when the ANC left? Okay. In January 2018, the mayor of Tshwane, Solomon Simanga, released a press release claiming he had clawed the city back from financial ruin. He said a deficit of 1.3 billion had been reversed. A year later, DA Member of Parliament Phumzile van Dam said her party had inherited a 2 billion deficit, from, 2 billion rand deficit from the ANC. The ANC continued to refute these claims. They said the ANC left a surplus of 736 million rand in 2016. That's according to the Gauteng head of social development, Nandi Mayatula Khoza. ANC regional chairperson Khosi Maepa reportedly gave the same figure for the surplus. So what happens? Okay, so when a deficit occurs, when you spend more money than you collect, and let's go and have a look at the figures. In an executive summary, the Auditor General's report of the says that at the end of the 2015-2016 financial year, the city of Tshwane had a surplus of 884 million rands. But the city's audited annual financial statements gave a restated surplus of 1.1 billion rands. That figure includes corrections of accounting errors identified later. Right, so what does this mean? Does the DA know how to calculate a deficit? The International Budget Partnership in South Africa, it's a network that aims to make public finance systems more transparent. They said, they referred us to a press statement by Msimango, who said that we could use to cross-check the figures. It included a table calculating the financial performance of the municipality, and noted that capital transfers are recognized when coming to that figure. So now it turns out that in actual fact, without the capital transfers from national government to Tshwane, when the ANC left, they actually had a deficit. If you do not count those capital transfers from government, which are not part of your operational budget, right? So you're given a certain amount of money, and you generate a certain amount of money, and at the end of the year, if you're an independent, standalone, and profitable entity, then you will have collected more money than what you've spent. And that is called, and you will take the money that you come in and the money that you spent, and you put them together, and you'll say, this is my operational budget. This is the money that I got from operations, and this is the money I spent on operations. Right. So when you look at it that way, before the money has come from a national government, when the ANC finished balancing their books, their operational budget at the end of the year, they had more than a billion rands in debt. Then money came from national government, and then they said, well, now we had a 700 million rand surplus. So in actual fact, the way things look, the DA in actual fact is right. They have, in actual fact, it turned around a deficit into a surplus. However, I would just like to point out that when the Auditor General gets involved, things always get a little bit murky, don't they? Because it turns out that the Auditor General said that, in actual fact, according to his latest report, Tshwane's wasteful spending has worsened under the DA Council. Let's go and try and find that story. The Auditor General says Tshwane Metro under the DA has racked up more than 5 billion rand in irregular expenditure over the last financial year. Making matters even worse, more than 1.6 billion rand has already been irregularly spent in the current year. Auditor General Kimi Makwetu said that the city also failed to recover a large part of its debt. He said reasonable steps were not taken to prevent the waste of city funds. The majority of disclosed irregular expenditure was caused by non-compliance of the municipal supply chain management regulations. Disciplinary steps needed to be taken against officials who caused such wasteful expenditure, according to the Auditor General's report. The city's MMC for Finance, Marie-Louise Fourie, says this year's 1.6 billion rand figure includes expenditure on the smart meter and Wi-Fi contract signed during the ANC's tenure. So, according to all of this nonsense, it would appear that in actual fact the ANC did leave Tshwane in a debt, and the DA has in actual fact been able to turn it around. But in so doing, the DA has also been engaging in a whole lot of irregular expenditure. All right. So, is that a little bit better than what we had under the ANC? I guess you could say that yes, it is. But then when you have a look at the whole things, the expenditure on the ANC wasn't that bad. I mean, it was still after, you know, all the government swapping around of monies and so on, it was still in the black. So that's a good thing, isn't it? The DA has turned it around, has been running a tighter ship, and there were major problems in the Tshwane Metro's finances with their free Wi-Fi rollout, which is a lot of nonsense, and their smart meter contract with Pew. What a lot of nonsense that was. They were warned repeatedly that the thing isn't going to work. You haven't done your homework. And Pew has just been making money hand over fist. Installed a whole lot of smart meters that are supposed to be able to distribute electricity more efficiently, are able to calculate bills more efficiently, meant it would cut costs for the metro and would increase revenue coming in. It sounded like a dream, and of course it rolled out like a nightmare. And nevertheless, the city of Tshwane, that was under, what is that mayor's name again? Gwen Ramakgoka. Her brother or husband. He was the one who signed everything off there. And, a complete and utter mess. I was once in a meeting with that guy, that former mayor, where a proposal was being put that they would print 900,000 newspapers, a Tshwane Metro newspaper. They're going to print 900,000 Tshwane Metro newspapers and going to distribute it to every single home in Tshwane. Would have made it the biggest national newspaper in the country. Alhamdulillah, that deal didn't go ahead. I was just a little fly in the wall in that thing. The World Bank says it has cut its growth forecast for sub-Saharan Africa this year to 2.8% from an initial 3.3%. It says the commodity slump of 2015 cut short a decade of rapid growth for the region. The bank said growth could take longer to recover as a decline in industrial production and a trade dispute between China and the United States take their toll. Its forecast for the year means economic growth is going to lag population growth. So we're going to be putting on more people into the market than we're putting money into the market. And that's happening for a fourth year in a row. So that's adding pressure on pressure. And it will remain stuck below 3%, which it slipped to in 2015. In its latest report, the bank also cut its 2018 growth estimate to 2.3% from last October's prediction of 2.7%. The slower than expected overall growth reflects ongoing global uncertainty, but increasingly comes from domestic macroeconomic instability, including poorly managed debt, inflation, and deficits. Nigeria, South Africa, and Angola. I can't understand why Nigeria is part of sub-Saharan Africa, but there you go. Luckily, I've always thought about it as being West Africa. But maybe the World Bank has got different ways in which it divides up the continent. We're bundled together with Nigeria, South Africa, and Angola, which make up about 60% of sub-Saharan Africa's annual output, all facing various challenges, curbing their contribution to growth. This downward revision reflects slow growth in Nigeria and Angola due to challenges in the oil sector and subdued investment growth in South Africa due to low business confidence because of Business Day's lousy editorials. Really, is that mean and nasty? No, really, seriously. Business Day and its former editor, Peter Bruce, is it Peter Bruce, David Bruce, Nigel Bruce? Always get the Bruces mixed up. I think it's Peter Bruce. Has kept South Africa's economic debate stuck in a shallow and artificial environs of neoliberalism. Has kept us chained in there, has ensured that it has trumpeted the propaganda of the World Bank, of the International Monetary Fund, of like 17th century economics. Hasn't tried to find any kind of like South African solution, primarily because it's like such a British focus kind of newspaper. hasn't found any, hasn't been able to generate or attract or inspire in any way a South African economic theory. You know, an economic theory that is suited to the South African environment and isn't something that has been cut and paste from something out of the London School of Economics. You know, someone stole a term paper and it stuck it on a toilet wall. Business Day comes along and grabs it down and puts it onto its editorial page on a weekly basis. That's Business Day. But in a way, it's kind of like reflects the South African environment. No one is really thinking any further than making a buck and forget about everyone else. And, you know, unfortunately, we now find ourselves in a situation where the system has been unable to deliver really, truly, on the expectations of 1994. Simply because the system has been unable to evolve, unable to adapt, because it's like all scary men like Peter Bruce that have kept us constrained. And the sooner we get rid of nonsense like that, the better for our country. We really need to find our own way going forward. You know, finding a just transition from coal. There was like something that gave me hope that there are people in South Africa who do think, yeah, we do need to move away from coal. We do need to cut our carbon emissions, but we're not going to do that at the expense of beggaring villages, of depopulating rural zones, of turning former coal mining towns into ghost towns. Look what has happened with our energy policy since 1994. We've been blundering from one thing to another thing. We've gone on to like Mbeki's nuclear deal through to Zuma's nuclear deal. And now that nuclear deal is off the table, but now Jeff Khadebe is speaking about his nuclear deal. And in the meantime, and we're also going to have sustainable energy sources like solar and wind. So are we going sustainable? Are we going nuclear? Are we going coal? We've just signed, we've got like 200 years worth of coal left under the ground. Transnet has just signed another huge big coal field development plan with Botswana. We're going to be trucking coal out of this country and it's going to be burning all over the planet for a long time to come. You get people coming into South Africa investing in the coal sector. They say, people say that it's a sunset industry. Well, let me tell you what, in terms of history, the sun can take a very, 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 very long time to set. So we'll let you chew on that. We're going to go across to the marketplace. Inshallah, we're going to be back in just a little while. Don't go away.
You are listening to the voice of Ahlus Sunnah wal Jama'ah.
Assalamu alaikum. Welcome back. Remember, if you want to call in and share your views, perhaps there's something that's been happening here, something you want to talk about, the Guptas. You want to talk about Eskom. You want to talk about the price of milk. Sure, you drive around Lanesia, you go to the Lanesia shops, and I'll tell you what. The price of milk. Now, there is something that housewives keep a very close look on. Going shopping with my wife, it's like, you know, you've got to visit six or seven supermarkets, you know, to make about ₹5 difference between milk prices. You know, I know better than to get involved to try and step in front of that particular oncoming train. I had a lot of experience taking my dear old mother shopping, and when it came to butter prices, will you look at that? I can't believe it. Can't believe it. That's the price of butter. And that was my mother, and with my wife, she does. She's not a big lover of butter. But when it comes to milk, well then, you know, you've got to. They have been in and out of all kinds of stores in Lanesia, chasing down the cheapest price of milk. Right now, there's a little shop opposite the taxi rank that really does a really great turnover, and they've got really good prices. Cheapest eggs and cheapest milk in Lanesia, found in a shop opposite the taxi rank in Rose Avenue, just on the same corner as the KFC. So if you're looking for good price milk, that's where you need to go. If you're looking for good price eggs, that's where you need to go. Yeah, eggs getting really expensive, and it's really interesting to see how these small retailers are able to actually bring out lower prices than Checkers and Pick and Pay. It's yeah, it gives you hope. You know, people say that South Africans lack entrepreneurial spirit, but I don't think so. I think in actual fact the big thing that prevents us from really realizing our potential is the actual system that we live by. It's not really. It's how we tax. It's how we decide to build roads. It's who we decide to build roads with. As I've said many times in the show, South Africa needs to establish a new kind of company. A kind of company that is in actual fact Sharia compliant. A family-based company that can only have shareholders who come from the family. In other words, you can't sell shares in this. You can only inherit shares in this. If you're born into the family, you can be born into the shares. As a result, the company is not transferable. And as a result, you know who the shareholders are. These are two very big differences that differ from the traditional Western style of company. You have a closer control over your directors. You don't get these rogue directors who come take over because they serve in the interests of a dominant shareholder. Or perhaps they share in the interests of family companies that kind of like keep pace with this company, you know, to get the good deals that fall off and so on. There are many ways of making money in business. That you can make money in business by making a loss, you know. Kind of like reminds me that, I mean, basically, that's how Tito Mboweni, probably illegally, paid off Christos's net open foreign position. It was basically the slush fund for apartheid's death squads. That's what Tito Mboweni paid off. And he probably did so illegally. And the way Chris Stolz did it was most definitely illegally. Everything about it was illegal because you had international sanctions against us in those days. But nevertheless, although the sanctions had been lifted, they were the law then. And you've got a 32-year prescription period on criminal matters. So Tito Mboweni better hope that he never doesn't end up in jail in his old age for paying off apartheid's odious debt. How was it paid off? Well, you see, Christos deliberately racked up losses in his net open forward position in the final years of apartheid. In fact, I think it was He ran up losses in his forward trading. I think it was in 97 and 98. After apartheid, Chris Stolz paid off apartheid's debt and then by running up a loss in his forward dealings, in his currency dealings, you guarantee a loss. You know that the price of the rand is going to be 7.50 next month. And you say that you'll buy dollars for 8.50. That means that someone not only is getting a very good deal in the spot market, but then at a later stage when he comes to sell his rands and the rand is recovered, he's going to make a huge big killing. And that's essentially what happened. I'm not going into the details of the whole thing, but there you see you can make a loss and you can make a profit as a result out of it. There are many ways of making money in business. Regarding the World Bank's report on sub-Saharan Africa, it says high inflation, heavy debt loads have discouraged investors in economies like Zambia and Liberia hitting their growth prospects. Rates of debt in the region are growing, and the type of borrowing countries are undertaking is exposing them to vulnerabilities. He says external debt is shifting from traditional concessional publicly guaranteed sources to more private market-based and expensive sources of finance, putting countries at risk. And they're obviously saying they're not coming to the World Bank for their loans. They're going to the private market. We don't like that. By the end of 2018, nearly half of the countries in sub-Saharan Africa covered under the low-income country debt sustainability framework. Luckily, that doesn't apply to South Africa because, like Saharan, it's still not about 90% of our national debt is locally owned. And that was also, well, in, you know, that's also thanks to apartheid. But we won't go on about that. I'm not going to thank apartheid for anything other than dying. Thanks, apartheid, for dying. It's a bit like President Trump saying, yeah, well, now I'll wait for the apologies from the mainstream media for trashing my name. And I saw some guy stand up on television and says, I'll be the first one to apologize. I'm very, very sorry that you're a bad president. Ah, there you go. Well, I'm not laughing at my joke. That's not one of my jokes. So, anyway. Economies that do not depend on commodities like Rwanda, Uganda, Kenya, Benin. Kenya. Why is Kenya being included in this thing? They've got a very strange way of dividing up Africa as the World Bank. So when they talk about sub-Saharan Africa, they really mean it, you know. They don't have East Africa and West Africa and Southern Africa. No, there's a sub-Saharan Africa. That's okay. Fine. Economies that do not depend on commodities continue to grow strongly. Albert Zoifak, the chief economist for Africa at the bank, said the region could boost annual growth by nearly 2 percentage points if it harnesses information technology more effectively. Why did he even bother to open his mouth? Huh? You know, he said it's a game changer for Africa. I wonder if he's even been to Africa. He's the chief economist for Africa. Well, it's a bit like old Chris Hart being a chief economist and doesn't have an economics degree. Shares in IO Technology fell to a record low today as its former chief investment officer, Piwe Nodwele, told the inquiry into the affairs of the Public Investment Corporation the technology company had been grossly overvalued. In December 2017, the PIC controversially gave 4.3 billion rands to IO, acquiring a 29% stake at 43 rand a share. That valued IO at 14.8 billion rands. He says, but now Nodwele, who resigned in August 2018 without ever having signed an employment contract with IO, it's a bit like working for Islamic media, said on Monday even a billion rand valuation would have been extreme. He says it's not even worth a billion rand. But nevertheless, the PIC given IO 4.3 billion rand, that may at its 43 rand a share, that if you pay them 43 rand a share for all their shares, that means the entire company would have been worth 14.8 billion. But now their former chief investment officer says, no, in actual fact, it's not even worth 1 billion rand. He says even a 1 billion rand valuation would have been extreme. He says a maximum valuation of 700 million rand was probably more realistic. He said there is no real intention by the company to deliver on its pre-listing statement, including its ambition revenue targets. He said that they deliberately misled the market. He said basically he's saying that this company was established so they could take a loan from the PIC. All that nonsense about, you know, cross-market synergies and we're going to bring in the latest software developments and all that kind of stuff is all a lot of nonsense. Basically, this is a company whose only real job is to park a 4.3 billion rand loan. He also said the 30% stake in British Telecommunications SA, which IO had pledged to buy from Africa Equity Empowerment Investments for 990 million rand, was only worth about 180 million rand. The PIC's investment is under scrutiny at the Mpati Commission of Inquiry into the PIC. The state asset managers vow to recover its investment. IO shares fell to a historic low of 14 rand today, valuing the company at 4.8 billion rands. However, the bid price for IO stock, which reflects the price at which investors are prepared to buy, was just 1 rand 14. So it seems that it's not selling. If a single trade goes through at this level, the PIC will have lost 97% of its 4.3 billion rand investment. All right, so no one's buying. Last week, IO's financial statement showed that more than half of its pre-tax profits in the 6 months to February came from interest earned on the PIC's funds. Right, so, you know, so Iqbal Servsgi is going to the PIC inquiry and said, yeah, but I look at my results. Look, I've got the profit here. What's wrong with you? But it turns out that most of his profit has actually come from earning interest on the loan, the money that he got from the PIC. So he's just a Reba merchant. And his name is Iqbal Server. That's very sad. He's living on the Reba. IOZ investment revenue from bank deposits leapt from 38.2 million rand a year before the PIC investment to 150 million rand in the 6 months of February. That equates to a 56% of group profit before tax of 266 million rands. Iqbal Server told the Party Commission last week the PIC's investment was very legitimate. I mean, he's obviously not... IOZ current chief executive Howard Plykes was chief operations officer at investment, while corporate affairs director Vanessa Govender was the company's executive for human resources. A close relationship between IO and independent meant it was easy for Server to ask for favorable articles to be published, Nadwele said. He said editorial independence at independent media does not exist. I wonder, you know, it did exist for a little while there, you know, just prior to 1994. The period sort of halfway through 1991 to 1994 after the elections. There was editorial independence at independent newspapers. It was really a rare privilege to be part of that. Yeah, but Tony O'Reilly came in and shut all of that down very quickly, I must say. And now the JSE has been summoned to appear before the PIC inquiry. It has to explain why it did not allow the Sagarmatha Technologies listing to go ahead. Now, survey says that Sagarmatha would have been bigger than Uber. In fact, it says it would have been bigger than APSA. Yeah. He says this company was like the best thing that had ever happened. And the only reason it didn't happen was because the JSE didn't allow it to go ahead. And the JSE didn't allow it to go ahead because it said that it hadn't published its results, audited results. It hadn't published its audited results, and that was why it wasn't allowed to go ahead. Now, there's been a bit of shifting in the story. The survey was adamant that in actual fact that they had sent through their financials, and in actual fact the JSE just ignored them. He says that they did this because their competitors TCO Black Star, which owns Business Day, and E-News 702, the two white media organizations in South Africa, had been waging a campaign against independent newspapers, blatantly putting negative propaganda in the public space to force the JSE to look for a reason to stifle the listing. He claimed Sagarmatha, listed in New York, would probably have a valuation of $10 billion. Now, it would seem that the JSE said Sagarmatha did not submit its annual financial statement to the CIPC, that's the company registrar, on time when the pre-listing statement was approved. This represents a contravention of the Companies Act and therefore of the JSE's listing requirements. The JSE said it was not aware of the annual financial statements had not been said it was not aware that the annual financial statements had not been admitted to the Registrar of Companies when it approved the pre-listing statement, but once it found out about it, it said it wouldn't allow it to go ahead. So now we need to find out. We're going to find out tomorrow because the JSE is going to be called in, and we're going to hear exactly why. Why didn't the JSE allow that Sagarmatha listing to go ahead? Things haven't been going Iqbal Server's way, I must say. Things have not been going independent newspapers' way. Maybe, you know, it's going to result in a breakup of the group. Maybe it's going to result in independent newspapers becoming independent. Can a newspaper run? Well, you know, it's got a title, it's got a name, it's got a presence in the marketplace, it's got more than what most internet sites have. So it has advantage. And if they play the games right, I reckon that there's no problem converting a newspaper into a website and then playing off your distinct advantages on either side. Newspapers are not completely dead. They still have a function, particularly with the younger generation. If you can persuade the younger generation to every now and then pick up a newspaper, simply because it's a bit like going and playing a game of Monopoly in a restaurant or a pub, which is what's happening in Europe and America, I know, because I've got a lot of relatives overseas. You regularly see them meeting in a pub or a restaurant and they're having a Monopoly evening. Oh, just last week, my grandkids, step-grandkids, were across the road playing Monopoly on a Monopoly board. I mean, it's really strange. People of my generation haven't played Monopoly for 20 years, and suddenly the grandkids are coming out, pulling out Monopoly boards. I'm like, where did you hear about this stuff? They want to play Scrabble and all of these games. You know, we can actually hold stuff and move it about the table. I mean, apparently this is it's really like a kind of quite novel for them, you know, because they've always got their smartphones, always playing their silly games, Candy Crush and what's it, Angry Birds and all of those things. if kids can move back to board games, they can also, every now and then walk in with a newspaper under their arm just to kind of like look cool and alternative, you know, retro. So if newspapers were to play off on this, plus the fact that newspapers, by being out in the world, by having the, you know, posters on lampposts and so on, they have got a presence in the physical world that the internet sites don't have. And that is a major advantage that should be played off, because, on the internet sites, you never know what is real and what isn't real. You never know, is this internet site a genuine internet site? You don't know if they've got like real people behind it or if they're just cutting and pasting stuff from somewhere else. I must admit, we can sometimes be a little bit guilty of that. We do change our copy though. We don't cut and paste the stuff and read it out on our news bulletins. But we do rely to a great extent on other news agencies. We go and find out what they're reporting, and that's what they're doing it to everyone else as well. I was working at MoneyWeb, but it's a major issue. Working at the Citizen trying to get off News24, taking off MoneyWeb. People going and suing each other left, right, and center, but in actual fact, it turns out then everyone's doing it. Hard copy still has a role to play in the world if you play your cards right. Unfortunately, the imagination and innovation at independent newspapers and many newspaper places really fell away in the late 1990s as consolidation and ownership and concentration of ownership started happening and sweeping across the media world. And as a result, you know, they started moving to what they called entertainment journalism. And so now instead of having a real journalist in charge of the newsroom, you get your little entertainment bunnies to come from the Tonight section. They've done nothing but rewrite press releases, and now I'm the news editor telling you, like, real serious journalists who've been, like, you know, spilling blood for decades for journalism, and I go and listen to a bimbo. All the serious journalists leave, and the bimbos just pull in, the prostitutes, all of these little, you know, it's a kind of university. I want to be a public relations officer. I want to work for a journalist for 2 years so I can go into public relations and talk about how I used to be this hardened journalist. Like, for the next 20 years, I'll talk about how all of the hard times I had as a journalist. And boy, I really know all these journalists. Like, you know, you'd swear, you talk to the public relations officers that we've been intimate terms since nursery school, but in actual fact, this is not the case. I'd say about 80% of newsrooms nowadays are filled with these kinds of people. People who are dreaming, who've got ambitions of becoming a public relations officer. It's Western institutions. I guess I'm not going to shed any tears for it. But I must say that my heart does feel a twinge. The National Energy Regulator of South Africa, that's the organization that decides how big Eskom's tariff is going to be allowed to be this year. Eskom's always wanting it bigger. They're the guys say, you're not going to have that much. Well, you know, Cyril Ramaphosa, amidst great fanfare in his State of the Nation address, announced that he was going to be given a 69 billion rand cash injection over the next 3 years. That's 23 billion rand a year to Eskom as part of a bailout plan. And old Pravin Gordhan stood up and said, yeah, and we're going to make sure that they spend it correctly. We're going to have an officious bystander who's going to come in and is going to ensure that, that, you know, there's no easy money being handed out, and we're going to keep close tabs on all of this. The National Energy Regulator of South Africa comes along and says, So Eskom, you want 15% increases. We see that you're getting the 23 billion rand from government this year. All right, so now we're going to reduce the amount of money that you're asking for by 23 billion rand before we decide how much of an increase we're going to give you. So NERSA has just completely nullified any kind of like financial benefit that they're going to get from the loan from government, because now they're going to get less money from us tariff payers. But of course, that money that the government gives them came from us in the first place. So, it's very difficult not to be ambushed by government, isn't it? Yeah, former white commercial farmers in Zimbabwe who had their land expropriated in the early 2000s have accepted government's offer of an interim payment of RTGS $53M, 53 million funny Zimbabwe dollars. That is apparently worth 238 million at current exchange rates. So it's actually linked to the dollar. The RTGS actually stands for, I know where is that interim payment of RTGS? I know it's here somewhere. Real time gross settlement dollar. So you come in with a Zimbabwe dollar and you say, I want to spend it. They go and look at what the dollar price is at the moment on the Bloomberg terminal. And they give you the then amount. One real-time gross settlement dollar today can buy you 4 rand 50, according to the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe this morning. In a statement, the Commercial Farmers Union said they had to accept the advance interim payment as some of their members were in financial distress. They says this is a limited fund. It is hoped that those who are not in financial distress do not take it up so as to maximize the effect on others not so fortunate. Wow, how Islamic.
It's hoped. Well, in actual, maybe they should be taking measures to ensure that that is not the case. They should be doing a means test or something like that.
The total bill could run into billions of dollars in terms of compensation for the farmers. The Zimbabwe government is working with other international financial institutions on how best to fund the compensation. The Zimbabwe government says by the end of April this year, the registration papers for beneficiary farmers will be complete and disbursements will commence. So they're not like the actual veterans, like, you know, the 25-year-old veterans that ran onto the farms who hadn't actually been born when Zimbabwe was given independence in 1980. They didn't have to go through a registration or verification purpose, but the farmers are having to go through it. Well, good for them. Hopefully the Zimbabwe government is going to keep its word and honor everything, and everything is going to become some kind of healthy basis. White people and black people living together in peace in Africa. Maybe it's time we started moving up to Zimbabwe. You get all these funny, strange reports about what people should be doing after the May elections. There's been threats of going and burning houses and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, you never know if you really should be paying the attention to that kind of nonsense that you get onto social media. And that's the kind of thing, you see. Social media news, very often you don't know, is the social media news reliable? And that's something that the newspapers have, that they could be working on. You could work out a really nice, trendy... Newspapers could become a retro cool if they play the cards right and if they design themselves right. Redesign themselves completely, be completely unrecognizable to like the store used to look. You need to be something neat and compact to you that a millennial can put under his arm, and he can walk around showing people that he's actually got real news out of the real world, you know. Well, it would appear that we now have reached the end of our time. Jazakallah for joining us. I make dua that whatever trading activity you got up to today has been profitable and above all halal. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You are listening to the voice of Ahlus Sunnah wal Jama'ah.